I came into ministry in my mid-30s. Right. I left school at 16, trained as a child surveyor, left a business to go into ministry when I was in my mid-30s, and always from that point felt it a huge privilege and a passion. I think it was my heart passion as well. So I really missed business. It was something I missed, all the cut and thrust of that. But I've always felt this to be something, just a huge privilege.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name is Adrian Reynolds. I'm the head of national ministries for the FIEC. And I'm here with, let me see if I can get the name right, still want to get it wrong, Trevor Archer. That's right, Trevor.
That's right.
It's right,
Adrian,
yes.
That's correct.
Trevor Archer, who, as we record this, is our director for London, but soon to be no more.
Extinct.
As a director for London. I hope you'll still have a few years left in you, have you, Trevor?
I hope so.
Yes, I hope so too. And we're here just to talk about lessons from ministry, really. Trevor, how long have you been in ministry?
Probably 45 years.
45 years. So it's fair to say you've picked up one or two tips over that period.
Hopefully.
One or two observations.
Knocks and bruises.
You're still going, which is testament to God's grace rather than anything else, I think.
Absolutely.
So it's good for us just to reflect on that, to reflect on life, to reflect on how the Lord has brought us this thus far, and actually just the things we've learned along the way. There's something to learn, I think, from our elders. You are, Trevor, my elder. Not actually physically in a church setting, but you are my elder in terms of age, and I'm very glad to sit at your feet and have done for many years, listen to you, and to learn. And you've written down a whole list of things here, which I think is a book, and we're going to turn it into a half-hour podcast episode.
Okay.
So thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And I notice down here that you've said nothing about family or nothing about your family. You've been supported all the way through your ministry by a wonderful wife.
Absolutely.
And not everybody who listens and is in ministry is married, of course. Some people are single and some people's marriages work in different ways. But I think it's fair to say, and I've heard you say this, hope you don't mind me saying it, that Val's been a really important part of your ministry journey.
Absolutely vital. I always say to people, where I see a man flourishing in church ministry, I know the reason, humanly speaking, if they're married, and that's his wife. So without Val and her support, there's no way I could have been this amount of time in ministry.
And actually, those who are married should always be investing in marriages. That's really important, isn't it? And those who are single should be investing in friendships. Those kinds of things are really important. Anyway, let's get to your list. You just wrote one in on the way. You wrote an extra one in on this list on the way in today, which you may have written in because the trains were so bad. It's something about a sense of humour being necessary for church ministry. Anybody who knows you, Trevor, will be surprised at that. You are a very, very sober guy. I've always
Richard Underwood and I had the ambition of putting the fun back in fellowship, but we failed, I'm afraid. But nevertheless, individually, we keep going.
Good. Well, why is a sense of humour important?
Well, in essence, it's that we take the gospel desperately seriously.
Yeah.
Because it is desperately serious and joyous and wonderful. But we don't take ourselves so serious, because at the end of the day, we're sinners saved by grace. So God knows what we like. God knows our failings. God knows our weaknesses. However, could we become too serious about ourselves, too pompous or whatever? But also, humor gives you a perspective. I think that without that, people struggle sometimes in ministry. You've got to see the funny side of ministry, the bizarre side of all of us.
Yeah, yeah. As soon as you're involved in people's lives, if you don't laugh, you just cry all the time. I think that's part of it as well. I mean, there are different kinds of humour, aren't there? I don't think there's been much slapstick in
ministry. Oh, it's till time.
Ministry.
I've got another month to go. I can arrange that for you.
But
your seat will collapse in a moment.
I'm a bit worried it's going to be like Mr. Bean, you know, or Rowan Axham, just going to sort of descend down on it. But you're absolutely right. You know, we mustn't take ourselves too seriously, but we must take the gospel seriously. And that's absolutely right, isn't it? And I think there are too many people for whom you just feel that that's the wrong way round. Actually, they don't take the gospel particularly seriously. They're a bit casual about the task that they're given. which is manifested in all kinds of different ways. It's manifested in prayerlessness, isn't it? It's manifested in, you know, not taking relationships and working relationships seriously. We'll come on to that. But actually, it is manifested primarily in making much of yourself.
Hmm. Yeah, and sadly, we see a lot of that around.
Yeah.
And that innate is in us all, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We can camouflage it and so on. But I think the more you journey on, I'm always reminded of Newton's supposedly deathbed. Two things I've learned. I'm a great sinner, but I have a great savior.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think it's having that before you each day really gives the necessary perspective.
And of course, you can have the outward appearance of success, making much of yourself. And that's what we see in very worldly terms, both inside the church and outside the church. Actually, by bigging yourself up, especially if you have a natural extrovert nature, perhaps, or a particular character that attracts people, you can make an apparent success of ministry, can't you? You can build a congregation, let's say, rather than build a church. You can build a congregation by being, you know, full of yourself. But actually, doesn't build a church, does it? Doesn't build gospel work.
No, and I think if we look back on our lives, as I do, and ask yourself the question, who has most profoundly affected you? Then almost invariably it's those people that have had that, that humor about them, but more especially that humility and God-centeredness.
Yeah.
So the best bit of advice I was ever given was by the guy who was my predecessor at Chessington as the pastor, Andrew Davis. Who, when I was embarking upon Christian ministry, said to me, Trevor, always look for where the Spirit is at work. And that's always stayed with me. So his point was this, that you can invest a lot of time and expend a lot of energy in trying to just keep things going or keep people going where there's little or no real spiritual life or appetite. Whereas amongst those people where that is evident, then put your energies there. And that's a bit of advice that's always stayed with me.
What does that look like in church life then, Trevor?
Well, I think just look where is God at work? Where amongst people, young or old, is there an appetite for God? Is there a seriousness about following Christ, about being his disciple? Mm. Is there a readiness to serve people? And I think, I always remember, one young man who got wonderfully converted came to a baptismal service because somebody had knocked on his door the day before and was converted there and then.
Mm.
Incredible. And rang me up the next day and he said, I went home last night. He'd been living with this girl who was, as it happened, was a daughter of an elder of a church down on the south coast. And he said to her, I'm sleeping on the settee tonight. She said, why on earth? He explained, I've become a Christian. Can't sleep with you anymore. And he rang me up the next day and said, Trevor, I have an issue with women. I want you to know that if you see me acting inappropriately towards women, I want you to come down on me like a ton of bricks. And this was like a one-day-old Christian.
Okay.
And you think, this is amazing because this is evidence of God at work. Because there's a ready humility, repentance, willingness to be disciplined, discipled in the right way, which sadly you can see people 10, 20 years down the track where that's almost the last thing they'd say to you is anything like that. So I think that's the kind of thing that Andrew had in mind.
Yeah, I see. How do you balance that though? I just want to explore that a little bit more. How do you balance that with, you know, some people are just slow burners. We both know that in pastoral ministry, that actually you expend a huge amount of energy on them. They don't seem to make much progress. But actually over time, over 10 years, you look at their lives, they have grown as a Christian, but it's kind of slow growth, but they have grown as a Christian. So we want, pastorally, we do want to be investing in those sorts of people as well, don't we? How do you make sure you don't, and it sounds like you're just writing them off. That's a bit of a harsh assessment of what you're saying, but you know, how do we make sure we don't neglect people like that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't mean that to be harsh in that way, because I think there's the whole issue of patience, isn't it?
Yeah.
I often
People have been patient with you, Trevor. That's the
this is the thing.
And me. That's what we've got to remember.
So one of the great stories I love. I once went to the Philippines with a guy called Andy Wyatt, who was an elder at Chesington, and we were visiting a couple that had gone out there to serve with OMF. And in the Philippines, they love their T-shirts, and the climate lends itself to it. So Andy and I are walking down this road in this town one day, and this guy is coming towards us, and he's got emblazoned on his front, "Don't give up on me. Don't give up on me." So we think it's the name of a pop group or something we've not heard of. The answer comes when he walks past us, and on the back it says, "God's not finished with me yet." Mm. So that, again, is one of those little things that you think that exactly that's what God is at work. He's purposed to do a good work in us.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not our place as pastors to write people off.
No, no.
I guess what I'm talking about, what Andrew was talking about, was in terms of making sure you're investing. Giving a priority to invest in people. It's not to give up on other people.
No, no.
And it is, but at the same time, it is to expect, isn't it, that you go on dealing with an issue where somebody's unrepentant about it. There's no point.
There is a shaking of the dust off the feet, isn't there? You know, we've got limited resources.
Yeah.
We're finite. And so we've got to be wise in how we deploy those resources.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You've been in ministry a long time. How have you kept going? You know, I ask that because, you know, there are great encouragements in ministry. There are discouragements too, aren't there? And it must feel at times like you're just plodding away. What keeps you going, Trevor? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, Val does. She generally kicks me out.
Okay. That's the value of a good wife.
I have no option. Go down and get her breakfast. So I may be a bit odd here, but I came into ministry in my mid-30s.
Right.
I left school at 16, trained as a child surveyor, left a business to go into ministry when I was in my mid-30s. And always, from that point, felt it a huge privilege and a passion. I think it was my heart passion as well. So I really missed business. I missed all the cut and thrust of that. But I've always felt this to be something, just a huge privilege. Mm. The second thing is Val. Val has kept me going in it. And thirdly, having good friends around. I think that's, at Chesington, we were blessed with, I was in a team ministry with John Tyndall. We enlarged that team. Others joined us. We had an eldership, which was kind of like a band of brothers. Mm. We were greatly helped by a guy who came in to help us as a who did this kind of thing of looking at sort of leadership, and having spent time with us at meetings and individually, he said this: "You're obviously, you know, you've got plenty of energy and vision and that kind of thing between you, but are you good friends? And do the congregation see that you're good friends?" And we thought we were, but he made the suggestion that actually we restructure our elders' meetings, which we did, so that we would meet at 6:30 and have a meal together for an hour. During that time, somebody would talk about what was going on in their life at that point in time. We would then pray together for an hour, not simply for one another, but for the congregation. And then we would restrict the business to 2 hours. And over a period of time, that really, I think, transformed our relationships together. And he made the point at the outset of this. He said, "Believe me, the congregation will see it." You know, because we were saying, well, they're not sat in elders' meetings. Yeah. How are they going to see it?
Yeah.
He said, "They'll see it. They'll see it." And I think that relational aspect. Now, I had the great privilege of being in a team. And I've always been in a team. And I'm very mindful of men and their wives that are in sort of sole pastorate and that kind of thing. So I always want to encourage them to find those friendships, either within the church. I don't go along with the thing about you can't find good friends within the church. You're part of a family together. Of course you can. But you can also find them outside, nearby, and so on, or not so near. So however you construct it, make sure that you've got people around you that are in your life, that are encouraging you. And that that's the thing, I think, humanly speaking, that kind of sustains that thing. So I've always found, even in the hardest times, never been despairing. Now, you know, And I've been blessed in that. I mean, that's a mercy from God.
Friendships do make a big difference to that, don't they? And that's interesting what you're saying. I think you're absolutely right. It does seem to me that so many elderships seem to function like having a business colleague. And I think, you know, churches, there seem to be more and more business to deal with as elders. You know, we've got to be thinking about safeguarding all the time. We've got to be thinking about policies. We've got to be thinking about all kinds of different things. And you think, where are we going to squeeze it in? Taking time out to build trust, essentially, and build friendships. It feels like, is that time we're going to, you know, not have to spend on all these other things? But it does pay dividends, doesn't it? Because actually you make decisions more. It's more straightforward to make decisions. You know how the other people are thinking when it comes to big subjects. So actually it does pay dividends to invest.
It does. And I think it reflects the one another's of the New Testament. Huge amount of one anothering, isn't there, in the New Testament that we need to be taking seriously. And I think too much of our business is kind of functional when it needs to be relational.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly right. Can we go back to the privilege? I'm interested in what you say there. I've just been doing a bit of work on just thinking about training up new leaders and really setting before them, I think, the two things that the New Testament holds in tension, which is that Christian ministry is both a huge privilege. You know, whoever desires a task of an overseer desires a noble task, a good task, but also there's a burden to it. You know, Paul thinks about the churches he has responsibility for. I know he's an apostle, but he thinks about the churches daily. You know, he sheds tears for them. You know, there's a real burden there, isn't there, in ministry when we see people reject the gospel or turn away from Christ. And I wonder, actually, if one of the little situations we're getting ourselves in now is that we've lost sight of the privilege of ministry. It's all burden to us. It's all cost. And actually, that's not sustainable. If you just have that vision of ministry, it's not sustainable. Equally, if you think that Christian ministry is just going to be a joy and there aren't going to be any heartaches, you'll be set up for a lifetime of disappointment. So we've got to keep the privilege ahead of us, haven't we? The joy ahead of us, and be realistic about the burden that it is. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I think the link in that, Adrian, is, as in Paul's life, it's the issue of grace.
Yeah.
It seems in the New Testament, he could hardly write a sentence or two without talking about grace, could he? So he thought about the grace that he had received, which was the motivation, the privilege, the apostle to the Gentiles. But when he was in tears and agony over situations and people, nevertheless, he was not despondent in the sense of just despairing, because he looked to the grace of God to be at work in people's lives and an expectation of that. And he had that generosity of heart, didn't he? I think that you see it there in Philippians, where he's kind of those that were preaching stirring up trouble for him.
Yeah.
And he says, what's it matter?
Yeah.
The gospel's being preached.
Yeah.
It's about the kingdom. And therefore, I think it maybe is a function, disposition, personality, this kind of thing. But for me, I loved business. I loved the business world. I still do. But there was this sense of this calling and this.
Is the business world poorer for you having gone into ministry, or are we better? Don't answer that. No. Don't answer that. I know exactly what you mean. Yes, so you are giving something up to go into ministry. There's a cost in that sense as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
Okay, can we just talk a little bit about partnership again?
So can I just tell a little story about that?
Yeah.
One of the guys,
depends how long the story is.
One of the guys I worked for, delightful Jewish man, property developer, very successful, built up a chain of cash chemists, sold out to Boots and this sort of thing. And when he heard that I was going into ministry, he rang me up and he said, oh, Trevor, you're only doing it for the money. He said, you know, it's like these American evangelists, you're doing it for the money. But then he got serious. He said, do you know, I do envy you because you know what you want to do. Mm. Now, here's a guy, he was about 50. He had more money. In today's terms, he was a billionaire than you could ever need. And yet he was honest enough to recognize that. I mean, he went on to offer me, he said, if you ever need money for a Christian project, give me a call. That's amazing. So that, I think that kind of reinforces this sense of this is what God has called me to.
I don't know many people who come to the end of a ministry, most of whom could have earned more money in the secular world. I don't know many people who come to the end of ministry and say, well, if only I'd earned more money.
No.
You know, it's not an equation, is it? It's not even part of that.
And God has been so good to us. You know, where we live, the part of the world we live in, not only the time that we live in. I mean, materially, we're millionaires on the world scale, aren't we?
Yeah.
And God has always provided for us and abundantly, and he will do.
Yeah. Let's talk about partnerships, Trevor. You're a great champion of partnerships. And we talked about relationships within the church, how, you know, a happy working environment is to see fellow elders as brothers and not just as co-workers in that sense. Let's talk a little bit about partnership outside of the local church, because you've modeled that. You've been a champion of developing, you know, meaningful partnerships locally and nationally. How did that work for you locally? When you're in Chessington, what did that look like? You know, you had a growing church, could have occupied all your time, but you didn't give all your time to it, did you? Gave a little bit of time to other things that were going on outside. But why was that, and what did it look like?
I think it was, again, was a kind of kingdom perspective. So one of the very formative things for both John Tyndall and I was to be released to go and visit our folk who have gone as missionaries and so on. And you know this, Adrian, when you go to another country, another continent, you see the flaws in your own culture and the barriers that very often as Christians we put in the way of people hearing the gospel. So that had a very transformative effect on both John and I when we thought about church and how we were going to think about the development of the King Center and things like that. But in locally, we had the opportunity. We had one of our elders was a guy called Ian Fry, and he had a heart to reach into the schools. So a period of 18 months, he and I travelled around about 12 local evangelically minded churches in the borough of Kingston, and cast the vision for them of having a schools worker in Kingston, which they got behind. So 12 churches. Brethren, evangelical, Anglican, Baptist, free churches, charismatic churches, got behind that. We set up a trust, got that going. Now, that was 35 years ago now. Today, there are 5 workers working for that trust.
Wow.
And it's just, but it's relational. It was built very much on relationships, and we gathered a board, one member from every church, who became very invested in the work and became advocates for it back into their home churches. And there was a genuine excitement, and it is to this day, of this is something we can do together as churches. Mm. And it's back to that thing. It's just not simply about our local church. It is about the kingdom in our area, the kingdom in the nation, the kingdom internationally. Yeah. I think it was a guy called Andrew Murray, who had the quote, which is along the lines that the pastor of every local church, however small, should have the ambition to see the gospel grow locally, nationally, internationally. He based that on Acts 1:8, obviously, that first church in Jerusalem that had that kind of mandate. And I think that became part of our DNA, really.
Yeah.
And that idea of what we can do far more together than we can do in isolation.
Let's pick up in a moment that. So I'm interested in that locally, nationally, internationally. I think in all of those areas, you've been a bit of a risk taker. You know, you talk about big, hairy, audacious goals. I know you like that phrase. Let's talk about locally. I mean, building the King Center, that was a big step, wasn't it? I came to the opening of the King Center. I don't know if you knew that or not. I came to the opening of the King Center. I had chicken pox. I wasn't very well. But I remember Cliff Richard.
Oh, that's why I went down with it.
Yeah, probably. I probably passed it on.
All these years, I've been wondering why I was so ill.
I remember. Did Dick preach? Dick preached. And Cliff Richard.
We've got Cliff Richard to open it.
Dick is the sort of Dick Lucas. This is Cliff Richard fanboy, obviously.
Yes.
And so Cliff Richard opened it. Did he come in by helicopter or something?
He turned up by car. And the lovely thing
is, what was the vision? So don't tell me the story about Cliff Richard. I don't want to know. But I do want to hear about the King Center. What was the vision behind it?
Well, the vision behind it was simply, as I go back to these visits abroad, I was going to India. John was going to Southeast Asia. You see the strengths and weaknesses and what we've exported.
But
when we thought about our own situation, this would have been 1980s in London, in England, in what was becoming a post-Christian society, and asking ourselves the question, what are the barriers that we put in the way of people coming to church?
Yeah.
And that could be simply the way we dress up on a Sunday, or it could be more especially the expectation that we have, the lack of accessibility and so on. Yeah. So we'd outgrown, in God's goodness, the small building that we were in that could contain about 120 people in a place called Parbury Rise. And the opportunity arose for a man called Mark Jilks, who was director of development at Kingston, who unbeknown to me was a Methodist lay preacher, rang me up one day and said, Trevor, I know you've been looking for land. We've got this redevelopment going on what is called the RAF Chessington base, which was a hospital unit.
Right, okay.
And it was being sold off for property development. And on it, as a planning condition, 2 acres were being given back to the community. On 1 acre, there was going to be a sports hall. The other acre could be used as a church. He said, would you like the other acre? Within a week, we went back to him and said, no, we'd like both acres. And we'd like to incorporate the sports hall into a multi-purpose, multifaceted church community center, which would be owned, run by the church.
Yeah.
He kind of captured that vision.
This is at a time when people were still building classic church buildings.
Yes.
They weren't thinking, I mean, nowadays people do think out of the box a bit more, but then that wasn't the case.
It wasn't. And there was nothing like it in the country.
Okay.
So we were 4 years in the planning of it. And I was working very closely with Mark on this. And in God's providence and provision, we would have never done it without him. He steered us through all the political machinations that we needed to. Yeah. So we were 4 years in the planning, just a year in the building. So at the end of the day, the developer, instead of building the sports building, contributed £900,000 towards the building of the King's Centre, which actually became about £1 million with interest payments and so on. The church raised £1.5 million, partly selling off our old previous building, but that was only 250,000, mainly just the church giving sacrificially. So we opened in that you came to debt free. So it cost £2.4 million. But the whole heart behind it was to make access for the gospel into the community and for the community. So under the roof of the King's Centre, we would do all the things that we do as church, run all our meetings there. We would secondly make it available for the community to come in and hire and use it, and a whole raft of businesses and colleges and individuals would come and do that. But the main thing was actually we started a raft of ministries, which were kind of bridge builders. Mm. So if a person had a hobby, had an interest, then we would start a ministry around that that would be offering something, whether it was learning English for folk from other countries, whether it's coming to play five-a-side football, badminton, all the stuff that churches do by way of children's clubs and all the rest of it. Yeah. And those became, the idea of that was that they would become the bridges by which people would come and hear the gospel. Now, the remarkable thing was that over the ensuing 10 years of that, that was 25, 27 years ago now, we expected a kind of, that God would bless us with a huge expansion of the church. That didn't happen in quite the same way. But what happened, in God's provision, there were about 12 couples that God raised up who the church got behind and sent into ministry and are in ministry today around the country. And so the growth locally was actually much smaller. Today it's really fascinating because Belle was just showing me yesterday a list of people that are currently coming to do a kind of just Hope Explored. And there's about 20 people which would have very little church connection who are beginning to come in on a Sunday. And so that aspect is happening, but it's in God's timing as it's happened.
It's so encouraging to hear. You've touched a little bit on sort of the international side as well. Let's just talk national. We're slightly running out of time, but I'm interested in how you've begun to say there how Chessington really had an impact nationally by sending people out into ministry. You've always been a great champion of national connections. You've worked for the FIC, obviously, so you're keen on that, I guess. I guess it's more than just a salary, isn't it? You're keen on it. But what's the value to the local church of national partnership?
Well, that's what I keep pressing upon people. It's so easy in local church ministry to become incredibly inward-looking.
I mean, you could fill all your time, right, with stuff in church.
So I always say to guys, you must get an outside gospel interest because it will raise your horizon, whether it's somewhere else locally, whether it's nationally, whether it's internationally. But that whole thing, and that will filter through to the church. It just will happen because you will begin to share those things with the church. But it's just a very strong way of reminding ourselves we are, in this instance, a fellowship of churches, and that the independency is a theological statement. It's not to be.
It's not a relational statement.
Not in
the sense of
and
how
we are to be. We are to be churches together because we can do far more together. So I find it very exciting these days to find churches like Banstead near us, having a connection with Medhurst Ministries in Middlesbrough, church there, Gunnersbury, that has a connection with Everton. Mm. These things are going on, and they wouldn't happen. The ministry in those places wouldn't happen anywhere near as effectively as they are without the support of other churches. So it's just this simple thing. We do far more for the kingdom together than ever we do in isolation. And it's to have that heart and perspective, isn't it? That we have a nation that's in dire need of the gospel. And we see that on our doorstep, and we can feel overwhelmed by that. But also, let's not forget that God is at go where the Spirit's at work.
Well, indeed, I was going to say that sounds like go where the Spirit is at work. You know, there's a huge mission field out there, isn't it? Trevor, thank you very much. Sadly, we run out of time, so I can't ask you for your favourite joke. Which is just, that's a real loss. We'll maybe put it in the show notes. but Trevor, I don't want to embarrass you, but you've been a great help to me over the years in ministry, a great encouragement to me, and I know to many others. And, you know, it's important, isn't it, to give honour. I think where honour is due. So without wanting to give you too big a head, I'm thanking God for you and for many years of service. And I know you'll go on serving. Just because you're not paid to do it doesn't mean you'll stop serving. I know you'll go on. So praise God for you and Val and all the things you've done over the years. I think even when I was starting as a very young pastor, and the reason I came to the opening at Chessington was because, you know, you've been an influence on me, and I'm very thankful to God for you. And I think there are lots of guys who that's their testimony. So praise God for that.
Bless you.
And thank you very much, Trevor. And this has been Independence. If you've enjoyed the podcast, do rate and review us because it helps people to find us. And we'll catch up with you soon. Thank you, Trevor.
Thanks, Adrian. Bless you.